temperatures are slowly climbing. Wind is calm. It is 71 degrees. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, next. Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andreas, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andreas, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD-HD. I'm Gregory Berg. It's exciting, as always, to welcome back into our studios Nan Calvert, who joins us once a month to offer up an interesting conversation about something related to the environment around us. And today, we're going to be speaking about one of the most important aspects or elements of the environment around us, namely water, clean, fresh water. And it's maybe a bit easier where we live to take this precious resource for granted. There are all kinds of places all around the world where that is simply not possible, where water is terribly, terribly scarce, maybe terribly expensive or inaccessible in one way or another, and that is something that causes all kinds of hardship on people, young and old alike. And it's something we all need to be more aware of. And one person who is working very, very tirelessly on this issue to try to raise awareness, particularly among young people, is Joan Rohr. And many of you know Joan, but maybe some of you are not aware of the great work that she's doing with something called Adventure Kids Learning right around this very specific topic. And that's our specific focus today. So Nan Calvert, Joan Rohr, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you.
Thank
Glad
you,
to be here.
So Nan, explain your connection to Joan and how you found out about this crazy adventure of hers.
Well, you know, it's a small, small world, as they say. I discovered that we had a connection with a mutual friend of ours, and she connected us recently because I was unaware of Joan and the great good work that she's doing. And the first thing I said was, I think she needs to be on the radio. And here she is.
And you've been on the radio before, so we're expecting great things.
Yeah, it's like second home to me here WGTD.
So really, really good to have you here. Ahead of us talking about Adventure Kids Learning, I think it would be interesting for our listeners to just have at least a sampling of the many and interesting things that you have done in your professional career, many of which have been around the sort of the central focus of teaching and learning in one way or another, but in several different arenas.
Sure. And thanks for having me. I totally enjoy this medium as well. It's radio is very precious, the art of it, and I'm super happy to be here. Adventure Kids Learning, first of all, isn't a one-woman show. I'll say that cliche, it takes a village. I do have a co-founder, John Anderson. We started 10 years ago, and let me tell you why John couldn't be here today. Hmm. Talk about small world. He's with his nephew Noah at in New York at an open house for the school Noah will be attending in September.
For goodness sake.
So he played Joseph in the amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat of at Racine Theater Guild. So it's all very interrelated here.
I guess so.
10 years ago, I got a call. I was with the Kenosha Unified School District as a distance learning facilitator. My focus was to foster distance learning. We had four ITV classrooms, they were called, where students at the high schools, Bradford, I'm trying to think who had them, ITA, Tremper, Ruther, where they could go into a classroom and receive accredited coursework. So, for example, Indian Trail taught Mandarin Chinese. A school in Bayfield didn't have a Mandarin Chinese teacher, so they were able to teach via video conference. Mm. And I was brought in to help bring that, to foster it, as well as bring the feeder schools, the elementary and the middle schools, to these. We had to travel to do video conferencing, and that was my job. So 10 years ago, I get a call from John Anderson, who at the time and still is the IT director at Kenosha Water Utility. He's chairman of Wisconsin Water for the World. Long story short, he said, we are traveling with a team to Guatemala for 2 weeks. We'll be building a water distribution system. We happen to have an incredible resource right here to our east. Our students in our district don't ever think about what it takes to flush a toilet or turn on a water tap. So we would like to share that experience with them. So we got together, we brainstormed, we signed up 11 fourth grade classrooms to be their guinea pigs that pilot year. I was in the library at Southport Elementary when John and team were in Guatemala. We turn on the camera, and the Skype connection is made, and here's John, another person that helped start Adventure Kids, Sandy Masterson, on this mountain in Guatemala, covering their ears, trying to talk, but there were fireworks going off, and M-80s, the pump had just been turned on. I have goosebumps, because in this village where a rural village where women are spending 4 to 6 hours a day getting water, water just came to their village. And in 22 seconds, and that number changes every time I tell the story, I said, John, I will not be in a library next year. I'm going to be with you on that mountainside. So that was 10 years ago. We have for 10 years, our mission, Adventure Kids, is to foster next generation water advocates and bring the global water crisis into classrooms, and we do it virtually. So every year we travel to Guatemala, 2 weeks. We connect 30 video conference connections to classrooms all over the world, and we introduce them to the people in the village that we're working at, and we talk to them about what a third of the world is like that doesn't have access to water. So that's our primary trip, or our virtual expedition. That's kind of how we started. So a typical connection would be half hour, 45 minutes, talking about we want to find out where the kids in the U.S. or wherever they are, where do they get their water? How many access points do you have at your house? How many access points or water service do you think these Guatemalan families have? And we take it from there. It started as a very science-based curriculum. But what we learned when we had opportunity, we would get into the school in the village. And what we learned was kids want to know about kids. They want to meet each other. They want to bridge that cultural gap. So the science, and yes, water brings us together, but it's the cultures, the cross cultures, that really make these connections. And I could talk for hours about certain, you know, things that had happened, incredible moments during video conference connections, the empathy that our children here in the United States have. How can we help? What can we do? You know, why don't they have soccer balls? Why, you know, what do you mean they have to spend their afternoons getting water? This is tearing down walls, and that's exactly what we thought we would try to do, what we hope to do. Another instance where you asked about examples. So 10 years ago when John and I dreamt of bringing the global water crisis to classrooms, we dreamt about going to Africa, going to Central America, all of these places that were, you know, outside of our out of our zone. Little would I ever have imagined that Flint, Michigan would be part of that picture. So February of last year, I hosted town hall sessions from Mott Middle College in Flint, Michigan. That's those students, their stories, they needed to be shared. So I went to Flint. I met an amazing administrator, Margaret Green, at Mott Middle College. We put together a forum of students, and 17 video conference connections later, other students in the United States learned what it was like to be a young person in Flint right now.
So most of the time, your conferences happen in originate in Guatemala. Is that right?
Annually, we travel to Central America. Now Nicaragua has been added to that.
So within the borders of Guatemala, are we talking about different villages, a different village each time, a different story, or are we returning to the same place in Guatemala and the same young people?
Different villages. Similar region. So much like the United States, we have states, they have regions. So we typically work out of the Sololá region, which if you look at a map of Guatemala, there's an enormous lake, Lago Atitlan. Believe it or not, the water problems, same as in Nicaragua, based on a freshwater lake that is not good water. So different villages, although I've had one opportunity to return to a village that I was very special to me. And 2 years ago, I was able to return and see some of the kids that I had met there a few years prior, which inspired a whole different offshoot of Adventure Kids. But no, it's in. By the time we get back there, it's usually a new group of kids as well.
Right. So is it still John's group? Wisconsin Waters for the World, that is doing this work in these various villages?
Indeed it is. The Wisconsin section of the American Water Works Association is the professional organization for water utility personnel. Huge shout out to the Kenosha Water Utility. What a special group of people. What a special leader we have in Ed, who knows and his passion is, you know, allows part of his team to be able to go do this. But Wisconsin Water for the World is a mixture of volunteers from all across the state, and they travel. We go down there 2 weeks every year and help a village build a sustainable water system. It's extremely important to note that it's a sustainable system. Wisconsin Water for the World works very closely with an in-country NGO called Agua para la Salud, which is water for health. We couldn't do what we do without the trust and the relationship of a well-reputed NGO down in Guatemala. The last thing we would want to do is build a, you know, if you build it, they have it, and you know, it's theirs, but if something breaks, now there's no repercussion, and we find out, you know, there's no water for them because a mudslide took out service lines. That is not the case. The village helps us. They do a lot of prep work, and oftentimes, because it's very mountainous, we're usually at around between 7,000 and 8,000 feet in Guatemala. We're in the highlands. They often have to excavate land to build a tank, which is what our job is when we get there. We're working alongside them. And the Mayan culture is such that you have to help if you want to benefit what's going to happen. Meaning, if you want water, you're going to have to contribute. They sign logs that they've put in a certain amount of hours into helping dig lines or whatever. But Wisconsin Water for the World, very, very active, and with their partner organization, Agua para la Salud.
So what exactly gets built, and what makes what is built sustainable?
Good question. What gets built? The systems that we're most commonly working on or building are ferro cement tanks, which are near a spring capture. It's not typically a well. A lot of people think, well, you know, water systems come from a well. The most of the projects we've worked on are spring capture, meaning there's really good spring water at a source where usually this village is, the women are walking to get their water or do their laundry. So a spring capture box is built, a lower tank, which is about a 10,000 liter cement tank. Now, when I say that, there's no cement trucks. It is all hand delivered. The cement is carried in 100 pound bags by gentlemen from the village who pass me on a mountain like I'm standing still. But I really am standing still because this cheesehead at 700 feet above sea level is not acclimated to 8,000 feet. So these men just truck up the mountain with 100 pound sacks. Everything's hand mixed. A rybar frame is built. Chicken wire is applied. And I'm using my hands because everyone in the radio land can see what I'm describing. You know, it's kind of like a water tower, but on the ground, not with that column. And then layer by layer, about five layers on the inside, five layers on the outside, builds this water tank. That chicken wire kind of gives it earthquake resistance a little bit of give. It's built on a foundation that's built on rocks so that there is some earthquake give. But damage does happen. Mudslides can take out service lines. But these two, so it's a two-tank system, one at a lower elevation, one at a higher elevation. That pump is installed at the lower tank, which pumps water to the upper tank, and then gravity feed service lines go to about 50 homes. So the village we just worked at had 300 families, and this was our second or third trip back because these systems can't accommodate an entire village sometimes, a small piece of it. So we've been back to a village a few times to get the rest of the sector's water service.
Wow.
And the sustainability part is this NGO. They are in country. Honestly, the circuit rider, Alberto, who is Lynn. Lynn is an expat from the state of Washington who started the NGO. He has a circuit rider, and Alberto is like the prodigal son in all of these villages. He knows everybody. He's holding the babies, asking how grandma is. That's a trust. And if something happens, Alberto will say, we've got a bad line in this in Sacpochol. We need to fix it. And boom, it's taken care of.
Hmm. So they don't necessarily have the resources to, or the manpower or whatever, to build this themselves, but they are capable of overseeing it and maintaining it.
Yes, they're given a laptop because it is metered. They're trained. They're trained on certain aspects of it, but this is theirs. They own it, and it's checked, it's monitored, but for the most part, you know, we're working with them on this sustainable piece.
And so what you construct is not only this, in a sense, transport, so the people of the village don't have to travel down to where this spring is. This pumps the water mm-hmm. up to their village, and then beyond that, that water is pumped into certain homes?
Well,
did I understand that right?
Here's the question I ask every classroom. How many water sources do you have in your own home? Every toilet, every sink, every shower, I can see your gears turning, Nan and Greg. Average, we hear maybe 12 to 15. And then I'll ask the students, how many water services do you think the Guatemalan family have in their home? That key word is in. There's nothing in their house. It's outside the front door. A pila, which is Spanish for sink, is installed outside of their front door. So that sink is connected to the service. So they do walk outside, but it's a rather large cement three or two compartment sink, which gives them water service at their home.
Hmm. And so they take the water, in a sense, from their front porch
right.
and then use it however they're going to.
Right, and it buys these women 4 to 6 hours a day back to spend. They have large families. They create textiles for economic, income. They also help in the farm. So it's 4 to 6 hours is not unusual for the women and girls in these villages to spend getting water for their families.
And now that's time they can spend in other ways.
Exactly.
Plus, that has to be hard, I should think, even backbreaking work to do.
Well, they're still carrying it on their head. Like you might see a picture of someone, a woman fetching water, absolutely. Or in the case of the school at El Rosario, the girls of the school grab empty 5-gallon paint buckets and get the water from wherever that source was closest to the school.
Wow.
I'm just curious, Joan, is there a water purification system within the spring capture, or is that unnecessary?
Good question. Let me also preface, I'm not the engineer, I'm not the scientist, I'm, you know, not the water utility person, but that spring water is pretty darn good water. Mm-hmm. We do have water, we have a state lab volunteer that comes with us, Patrick. Kate from the Kenosha Water Utility, also, she's been my roommate. I've watched her test water. Interestingly enough, the spring water is less bacteria laden than the water in the hotel, I use air quotes, that we stay in. I turned on the faucet in a hotel down there once, and I think it was tomato leaves that came out of the faucet. So their water is pretty clean. They are advised, they can be taught chlorination. Mm-hmm. That's not necessarily a sustainable practice. Some do boil the water, but they're very acclimated to that spring mm-hmm. water. And if we did one well project this year, and I want to say it was, and again, I'm not the engineer, Roger, if you're listening from the water utility, mea culpa, but 300 feet down, water's pretty darn clear.
Mm-hmm.
And good.
And yeah.
So how does it get chosen, this particular village will be the project this year?
That's John Anderson, and Kate, also with Wisconsin Water for the World, all with Kenosha Water Utility. They meet with that NGO, Lynn, from Guatemala, Lynn Roberts. Interesting story about him. 22 years ago, he vacationed in Guatemala with his wife, and he stayed. And she went back, and he's been there almost 21 years, I guess, but knew that there was such a need for water. So constant communication with Lynn and John and Kate and that team to determine. Now, when we're there, a spec team of engineers, another Kenosha, Clark Dietz, goes down there, and they'll spec out potential projects for next year so that they know all the data that they need, and they'll determine how sustainable that water source is. You don't want to build water tanks on a spring that's probably only going to last another 2 or 3 years. So a good deal amount of research is done to pick the project that's going to work the best and be that doable.
So in a sense, an environmental impact study is done, probably a truncated version. In terms of the spring that feeds the next body of water, they try to assess the impact on that body of water?
I'll say yes,
okay.
But again, I've never been on that spec
<It's okay>.
team. We'll get John Eibolt from Clark Dietz in here, and Roger, and a number of volunteers that do that. I'll be the first to say I can't answer that, but I can get you that answer.
Right. For those of you just joining us, we have Nan Calvert in the studios, and she has arranged for a visit from Joan Rohr, the famous Joan Rohr, who for the last 10 years, so we're kind of helping you celebrate your anniversary, has helped oversee something called Adventure Kids Learning, which brings to young people in this area the story of this wonderful work being done in Guatemala and sometimes in Nicaragua also, you said?
Another local small worlds connection. A couple of professors at Carthage College, Matt Zorn and Professor Floffel, have been taking students on J terms from Carthage to Nicaragua for medical missions, basically, June and January. And many, many years they've been doing this, only to realize that all of the antibiotics they bring, all of the medications they bring, really were the result of waterborne disease. So you bring an antibiotic, it's only going to last so long. But if we fix the problem, we'll have a much better case of a healthier community. So they travel to Ometepe Island, Nicaragua, And over the last few years, they started an organization that has actually purchased property on Ometepe Island. It's called Finca de Esperanza, which is Farm of Hope. And I have been very lucky to, now they've built a water tank similar to that of what were, John was down there building in Guatemala, so that they have a water storage capacity. On Ometepe, there are three municipal wells which require electricity. And when you live on an island where electricity is a crapshoot, it's out almost on a daily basis at some point, you then have no water. They don't have any water storage solution. So there's exploration, I guess, and discussion in place as to how this island could really get some water storage, which would replicate tanks that we do in Guatemala. And, of course, I'm all over that because they've now built a 48-student field station on the island of Ometepe, which accommodates students to come and work. They have Doc Sandra is an overseer of the property, medical doctor, but definitely water issues on that island in the middle of this freshwater lake, which can be addressed by people that we bring down there. So my gears are always spinning as to as to how to get people to Ometepe to be part of a water storage solution or help there.
Right. So let's get a sense of what happens in these wonderful interactive video connections that you end up building. What typically would be seen on the screen by young people here? Describe what a typical program would be.
Sure. Well, technology has come a long way from 10 years ago. In the beginning, we were relying on satellite modems to the tune of a $1,500 rental, $5 a minute to send these free programs to school. To now, and I'll throw this World Health Organization question at you both. More people in the world have a blank than a toilet. Can you answer that? I'm putting you on the spot.
Cell phone.
You're right. Mm-hmm. Now the cell phone tower network in Guatemala is so great that we can literally usually rely on cell phone usage, cell phone towers. However, that can't take into account political protests that shut down cell phone networks because of the communication. So when you ask about a typical connection would be John on a tablet walking around the area we're in, and me, now we're offering two spots, maybe in the school or maybe at the tank, so that we can show the people working on the tank while John's walking around a village home maybe. And we all have permission to do all of this. The village is very welcoming and trust of each other in order to do this. And we're very respectful because it could be a moment that John sees a woman washing her hair at the spring site. And to us, that's a very personal moment. And we would never want that to be taken. We wouldn't want to take advantage of that. So we'll always ask, we see you're doing laundry. Would you mind if we, and 99 times out of 100, the people will say absolutely. So the camera angles are usually me at a stationary place, and John loves being the roving reporter and showing students. It could be a woman weaving. It could be women in their kitchen making tortillas. It could be a number of things. But definitely getting two different perspectives. And all the while, we're trying to encourage conversation. And it depends. We could be in the school. And when we're in a school, the kids want to talk to kids. But if we don't, and they only go to school in the morning. So our afternoon connections might be more science-based or more engineering-based. But typically what they're seeing is people on camera. They do not speak Spanish as a native language in Guatemala, which also poses another interesting twist. There are 23 Mayan languages in Guatemala, and the region we go to, they speak Quechical. So oftentimes we'll have to have translators for Quechical, Spanish, and English. So students, we try, and I feel we're very good at that, lead where the connection goes. If they start asking questions that are more, you know, science-based, we'll take it there. If they want to know more about the culture, we'll take it there. That's what makes it interactive.
Mm-hmm. So, for instance, when you're in Guatemala in a given village, it's in June? No. When is it?
Usually February, March time.
February, March. Okay. So how many of these connections occur? How many of these video conferences?
We had 30 last year, or in February of this year. So 4 a day, thereabouts. And we're very picky about quality of interaction. It would be super easy to say, let's host a video conference and let 500 schools join in. Mm. That to me is not quality interaction. I insisted all along that we have one classroom. That way we've got 20 to 30 kids. Everybody seems to get an opportunity that wants to ask or come to the camera. We've caved and allowed two because of demand. So we typically have four connections a day that we're down there, two classrooms each.
So it ends up being a fairly substantial number of young people here who get to experience this.
Right, and here being anywhere, we've connected with Ecuador, Australia, Canada. We have Lake Harborside is an expeditionary learning school. We have EL schools from Utah and Washington State, Oregon, California that connect. So it could be just about anywhere. But anywhere being water is not a trouble for these places we're connecting to.
Right. So in other words, this is not just something that students around here are benefiting from.
Absolutely not.
But young people from all across the country.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, and word of mouth. I mean, when I was with Kenosha Unified, I was lucky enough to be in a network of a lot of video conference educators. So that kind of helped.
Right.
But now, yeah, it's anywhere.
And it sounds like you are being really careful about doing this well, because I can just imagine so many scenarios in which somebody with the best of intentions would do this but not do it well, in terms of maybe not being comfortable in front of a camera, not being comfortable phrasing things in a way that will connect with kids, or there's all kinds of ways in which this...
Oh, and anything you can imagine has happened. I mean, to be honest, comfortable in front of a camera is one thing, but you're an educator, you both know when technology fails or something that doesn't allow technology to work, because it's not always technology. Mm-hmm. Like I said, this year we experienced incredible political protests in that country, and it's a lot of video bandwidth when you're video conferencing. But when there's communication so strong about where they're going to protest and all of that, it shut us down. So it often, you don't want to be in front of a classroom as a teacher with 30 kids. We're going to connect to Guatemala. We're going to connect. And then nothing happens. And it's heartbreaking. It's absolutely heartbreaking. So we call him MacGyver. sometimes we'll switch to just audio. Sometimes we're lucky enough to have somebody from the water utility, if it's a school in this area, be in that classroom, maybe with a few things, just in case something doesn't happen. But, oh, yeah, we've had definitely our share of, or when we were doing satellite, if you point the satellite in the wrong direction, you don't have a signal. Or we had a solar generator, and if a kid would walk in front of that solar panel, we would lose signal. So we've learned a lot. It's come a long way. But because we're both so very passionate about bringing this message, it's so easy to... want to do the right thing.
And what is that message?
That message is, do you think about flushing a toilet? did you know that?
That belongs on a bumper sticker, doesn't it?
November 19th is World Toilet Day. How anyone doesn't know that, I don't know. but how lucky are we? And that's a message we say in every connection. How lucky are we to turn on a faucet and water comes out, and we don't think twice. Right. And you'll be in a classroom of children talking to each other, and the Guatemalan children will ask the United States children, how often do you have water? And that's a stumper. Mm-hmm. You know, the kids look at each other. We have water all the time. Mm-hmm. Aha. You know, that mm-hmm. moment. Wow. And like I said, that empathy is incredible. It blows me away, and it shouldn't, but I hear it all the time. I don't even know how much time we have, but if I have a minute to tell a sure. quick story, one of the most incredible stories I've been able to witness, and there were several, was one of those town hall connections from Flint, Michigan. And one of the schools was a Chicago Public School sixth grade classroom. And the sixth grader, young woman from Chicago, said, "All right, how many hours? You're only like 3 hours away from us. How can we help you? Do you need water? Should we collect money? What is it that we can do to help you?" And Jazzy Harris, a 16-year-old student from Mott Middle College, said, "You know, it's kind of too late to help us. I don't know if you can help us, but I can tell you how you can help yourselves so this will never happen in your community. You need to stay educated. You need to know what's going on in your community. Be involved in your community and vote responsibly. Those three things will allow your community to not let happen what happened here. If that was all in place, we wouldn't be talking to you right now." A 16-year-old girl. Now, as a mom, as an educator, I can say, "Now, Greg, stay in school, vote responsibly," and I can hear your eyes roll as my child, you know, I hear my girl's eyes roll. But as a colleague, as a peer, as, you know, one of their own saying that, the CPS teacher told me afterwards, in all of my years of teaching, I've never had a more silent, extended period of time after that question was asked and answered. And for sixth graders to be quiet meant their gears were spinning.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about that experience in Flint, Michigan. Briefly, how did it happen? I mean, logistically, who did you connect with in Flint? And
oh, my gosh. You know, it was a big shout-out on Facebook. Hmm. I have been part of a number of groups on Facebook of Flint, Michigan residents. I knew that water was an issue there. I knew I wanted to learn more about it, and I simply put out, "Hey, I'm an educator. This is what I do. Does anybody have a connection?" Lo and behold, I was pointed towards Margaret Green at Mott Middle College, and she said, "Come." Hmm. And actually, I've been super lucky, and I have to get another plug in for Flint and Mott, because that was February of 2016. It impacted me so much that in March 22nd is World Water Day. If you didn't know that, everybody should know that. last September, I dreamt of an idea I had, and I wanted to host a 24-hour global youth summit on water. And I thought March 22nd is the day to do it, and I wanted to host it from Flint. So I dreamt of this idea. I called it Ripples Make Waves. I kept hearing so many, you know, and that Jazzy Harris, this young person who is a ripple, had made such an impactful statement. And I knew of so many stories around the world of young people making a difference that I thought, okay, this is an opportunity on a global platform to have this happen. I emailed UN Water in Geneva, Switzerland, and said, "I'm this crazy lady with an idea." They said, "We're on it. What do you need?" They opened it up. I have a contact that lives in Cranfield, England, at Cranfield University, home of the nanomembrane toilet, again, in case you didn't know, a zero infrastructure toilet. And we got to brainstorming. We got 25 speakers around the world. And on March 22nd, I launched the first Ripples Make Waves Global Youth Summit. And we had sisters from Bali, who started Bye Bye Plastic Bags, at the ages of 10 and 12, they petitioned the Bali government to ban plastic bags, and they were successful. They closed our summit. They're 12 and 14 now. Hmm. We had Little Miss Flint, Mari Kopeni, who is now 10, who Obama got a letter from her saying, "Will you come and help us with our water?" He flew to Flint to meet her. She spoke. We had the world toilet warrior, Mark Balla, from Sydney, Australia. Mark's quick story, he travels to India as a businessman, learned of the high dropout rate of young women because there aren't toilets in rural Indian schools. And young women, when they reach menstruation age, would like to have privacy and the dignity of a toilet. They're dropping out of school because they don't have a toilet. He formed an organization, We Can't Wait. Toilets, hundreds and hundreds of toilets have been put in. I could give you all 25 bios of our speakers, and it blew me away. I pulled a WKRP in Cincinnati 24-hour all-nighter at Mott Middle College, hosting one connection after another, and happy to say it'll be also in 2018. I speak at an international conference next week to promote it, and I'm fingers crossed, but I'm hoping for Standing Rock to be a location where the 2018 summit will be hosted.
So who was the audience for that?
Worldwide students. We had lots of surprises. I also partnered with an organization called CILC, which is the Center for Interactive Learning and Collaboration. They have about 55,000 teachers that in a database that use video conferencing for virtual field trips or to connect to experts outside of their classroom, and they helped promote it. So we had a worldwide audience. England, obviously Australia, because we actually had a live dive in the coral reef as well in Australia to talk about the bleaching of the coral. But the kids could talk to the diver while he was underwater. They'll be back. So obviously North America was a pretty heavy presence because a lot of my connections are here. But it was anywhere you can imagine. Florida, Australia, Sweden.
Wow.
God bless Sweden.
Amazing. And I saw that name, Ripples Makes Waves, and thought, that's such a great title. But I had no idea all the wondrous things that were behind that title. What a terrific idea, and how wonderful that it's going to happen again.
Well, I want young people to know they can make a difference. Most of the ones I know make tsunamis, but it didn't sound quite right to say Ripples Make Tsunamis. Didn't fit on the logo either.
Ripples Make Waves is great. By the way, what is the situation now in Flint, Michigan? I know that some kind of huge project is underway to replace the pipes there, but I don't think that...
It's not fixed. Uh-uh. It's not fixed. The students are still showering at school. I don't know the exact. I was lucky enough to meet the mayor of Flint. She came to Racine. She has a Racine connection. Gosh, I just couldn't be paid enough money to be in a position of leadership in that community. But it is not fixed. It is slowly they are replacing infrastructure, but they are still dealing with water bottles on a daily basis.
So daily life is, for at least many people in Flint, is the way it still was. For some people, is it different now? I mean, do some people have safe water in their homes coming
even
out
if
of it?
They do, they won't drink it. And that was one of the big questions that came out in that town hall. You know, a student asked, if they told you you could drink it now, could you? And every one of those students in Flint said, absolutely not.
They couldn't bring themselves to drink it.
No, I will never trust a municipal water system.
The trust is gone now.
It's gone.
Yeah. That's really sad and really scary.
Yeah, and it's in our own backyard.
Right. Well, exactly. This is
not to mention severe water issue, well issues in Algoma, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. We've got it creeping up.
Right. So, what is your message for people listening in terms of the way all of us think about water? I mean, I think probably your message is beyond just think about water more.
Right. Well. Yeah, that's tricky. Way to stump me in the last 2 minutes here, Greg. Know how lucky you are to have what we have, and don't take that for granted. Keep our beaches clean. Stop using single-use plastics.
Yeah.
You know, I can't say that enough. Plastic water bottles, no. Single-use plastics are killing our oceans. They're mucking up our water utilities, our waterways. Stop using them, and know how lucky you are to flush a toilet and have that go away.
I'm so glad every time so often when a Carthage student comes into my studio for a voice lesson, I almost never see them carrying a single-use water bottle anymore.
All right.
Almost all of them. And part of it is at Carthage, particularly in our building, we have one... in addition to the drinking fountains, these wonderful things you just fill up your bottle right there. And so it's as easy as pie. And, of course, we need more of those all over the place. So that becomes the new norm for people to do that. So the next time all of this conferencing is happening is when? Is that date? That
I'm hoping set of for dates? World Toilet Day, November 19th. I am actually hoping to bring a large group of women on a volunteerism trip to Nicaragua, because the women I know are strong women and don't mind writing out a check, but many want to roll up their sleeves and experience something like that. So my fingers are crossed to be in Ometepe in November. Always Central America, Guatemala in February, March, and World Water Day, March 22nd, likely from a Native American or a First Nation in Canada reservation.
Wow. Does Adventure Kids Learning have a website?
A Facebook page.
Okay.
Ripples Make Waves is about to launch their website. It has taken off. So Facebook page, most definitely.
So that's something people can look up. Is it at all possible at this point to see anything that you guys have done?
Tons of pictures on Facebook. We also do have some of the videos on Ripples Make Waves, that event, because it's pretty cool to see the impact of interactive video conferencing.
Wow. Well, this is exciting stuff, and Nan's been smiling most of the time here. This is right up your alley, isn't it?
Well, I'm blown away by the things that you've done and will do. And to think that you are part of our community is just amazing to me. I mean, we have so many truly amazing people in the Racine area that are doing such great good. And Joan definitely, obviously, is one of them.
And little known, but I'm big in Indonesia. I want you to know that.
A rock star in Indonesia.
I'm a rock star.
Well, you're a rock star here as well.
Yes,
Joan Rohr with Adventure Kids Learning. This has been terrific fun, and more than fun, it's been also eye-opening and inspirational. So
thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thank you for sharing the story. Nan, what's going on that you want people to know about?
Well, speaking of water, we have a kayak class going on at Riverbend Nature Center on June 17th from 9 until noon. The fee is $25 for members, $30 for non-members. Obviously, dress for the weather, dress for getting wet in case your kayak turns over or whatever happens. For more information, just contact Riverbend Nature Center. Sino Conservancy, my neck of the woods, on July 8th at 9 o'clock in the morning. John Holzwart, who is also known as Little John, who is actually a regionally famous expert in wild foraging and wild foods, will be doing a seminar. And so if you'd like to sign up for that, please call 262-539-3222. John is also an artist, and he'll be bringing some of the things that he makes. This will be a fascinating introduction into wandering around the prairies and the woodlands of Sino and finding out what's edible and what we can use and what we can't use. And he was recently on Outdoor Wisconsin as well.
Oh, I'd be remiss if I didn't say that number again.
262-539-3222.
All right.
Also at Sino on July 27th, beginning at 9 in the morning, a local and I'll say soon to be famous entomologist by the name of Rick Wadley will be doing a workshop on insects of the prairie at Sino. This is a family program. All ages are welcome. Kids 6 and under are free. The fee is $5 for people who are older than 6 years old. Dress for the weather. We will be outside, and we will provide nets and bug boxes and magnifiers and all that sort of thing.
Fantastic.
That number to call to register is 262-539-3222. And finally, Southeast Gateway Group of Sierra Club, June 21st, 6:30 p.m. at the Northside Kenosha Public Library. There will be a free screening of a film called From the Ashes. There will be a pre- and post-viewing activities. And please contact Southeast Gateway Group of Sierra Club to find out what you need to do.
Fantastic.
And that's it.
Nan Calvert, thank you so much for being here again. And thank you for bringing Joan Rohr here for a really terrific morning show conversation.
This I'm going to bring great. Her again 10 times in a row because there's so much.
Oh, no. Careful
to talk
what you
about.
Wish for.
Right.
I'll say matiosh, which is Kechikel for thank you.
Oh,
matiosh.
Matiosh.
Matiosh. Great. Well, thank you again for being part of the morning show today. Tomorrow on the morning show, Michael Connell, the author of a really interesting book called Incendiary. This is an interview that was supposed to air a couple of weeks ago. Finally, we'll share it with you tomorrow. It's the real-life story of a true crime event in Boston in the mid-19th century, which really helped reshape the way criminal cases are investigated. A fascinating story. And on Monday, a look back at a